Accession number 10496, reel 1.
Air Vice Marshal Stewart, reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Air Vice Marshal, whereabouts you come from and your family background?
Well, my people are all Scottish, but I myself was born in Dorset, Sherborne, and didn't in fact go to Scotland at all until I was something like 14 or so.
What was your father's profession?
My father was a draper. He travelled all his life and was in South Africa for two periods of about 6 years, either side of the turn of the century. It seems very odd now to think of a young married man going off for two such long periods and leaving his wife with their first child. But travelling wasn't easy, as it is now.
What was your education?
I went to local schools at Sherborne and then to a small public school called Wycliffe College in Gloucestershire.
Named after the famous medieval...
Yes.
And how old were you when you left there?
I left there. My father died whilst I was there, and I left earlier than I would otherwise have done at 16. I was 16 then.
What did you take and up?
another old Wycliffean came and asked the headmaster if he'd got anybody interested in the timber trade, English timber. He himself was 55, his son was 5, and there was going to be a large gap before his son took over, and the gist of the thing was to find somebody who would fill that gap. And I took this on and apprenticed myself to this guy and served there for 4 years as an apprentice, during which time I did all the practical things associated with the timber business. And I don't mean the foreign stuff where it all comes off a boat. I mean looking at a standing tree, finding out how big it is, felling, hauling, bringing it in, turning it into planks, seasoning, storage and sales, you know, or converting it when it was seasoned into furniture or other such things. So it was all very interesting. But about at the end of my 4 years, they offered me £2 a week, and this was not quite what I had in mind. And what was more, I had, during this period, living in Diggs, I had read every book on flying that I was able to lay my hands on.
Why do you think that you were so interested in flying?
I don't know. The earliest airplane I ever saw that I can remember was, in fact, a crash. It landed in a field within walking distance of Sherborne when I was must have been between 4 and 8. It was during the First World War. Created a great stir, but I don't know why, really. But it developed very quickly when I began to know a bit about the whole thing. And by the time I decided I was not going to be a timber merchant, I was quite determined to learn to fly. We had no connection with the Air Force directly. Well, I had two cousins who were killed flying in the First World War, but they were a generation ahead of me, really. I didn't know them. We had no great connection, so I hardly knew an Air Force existed. But I did discover that there was such a thing as called the Reserve, who would not only teach you to fly, but they might even pay you for a couple of weeks during the summer when you were doing your regular stint.
This was the RAFVR.
The RAFVR. And from that, it was a short step to find out about short service commissions. I was then 21, too old to go to Cranmore. And so the only thing I could do was to go in as a short service officer. And this was my problem. I could see the future. I could see myself coming out at 27 with no more saleable article than the ability to fly an aeroplane, which at that time was probably not really very important qualification. But I would have had 5 years doing what I desperately wanted to do, and that won. So I joined, but with the very fixed determination to stay in if I could. You had at that time about a 1 in 10 chance, roughly, of getting yourself a PC eventually. And so that was my plan, my aim, my whole business. It was circled around that, really. And I loved every minute of it.
How did you take to the actual flying training? Did you find it easy to learn to fly a plane?
I took what was regarded as the sort of statutory 10 hours to go solo. If you went less than that, you were doing jolly well, but quite a few people took more. And I was usually, in fact, I think right through my logbook, I was assessed as above average for what that's worth, you know.
Can we jump ahead in your career to going to India?
Yes.
When you were with 5 Squadron in 1933.
Yes.
And can you tell me what the equipment and function of 5 Squadron was in India?
5 was at Quetta with another squadron, 31, and we were what were known as Army Cooperation Squadrons. And that described our function pretty well. We were there to do whatever was possible to do for the army on the ground, short of aerial combat. We didn't go looking for aerial combat. It was an anachronism in a way, but I think it would be perhaps more kindly described as a stage in the development of the philosophy of the air in relation to the other services.
Can you enlarge on the type of jobs that the Army Cooperation Squadrons did in India?
Yes, we're recce, of course, was the obvious one. You could see on the other side of the hill and all that stuff. You had remarkably unsatisfactory communications. You had none at all with the army itself, but you could talk to an RAF ground station who supposedly relayed the information you collected. The artillery fire spotting. You reported the fall of the rounds relative to the target. And supply dropping. Pretty meager quantities, but there was such a thing as a supply dropping canister, which was about the size of a milk churn. And it had a parachute in its top end, which went in on top of the load, and a collapsible bottom end, which collapsed when it hit the ground and broke the fall. And I think I don't remember dropping anything real in those things, except one Christmas when we took some alcohol to one of the very remote little army posts on the frontier, which was well received. Then we did. We never quite forgot that we were also capable of shooting down other aeroplanes or doing an air-to-ground strafe, and we did do air gunnery, both air-to-ground and air-to-air, and we did dive bombing, quite a lot of dive bombing on a local range.
What kind of planes were you flying?
Wapiti. It was a two-seater thing with a Jupiter 8 engine, big radial engine. It flew, I think, probably about 1936 or 7. It flew over Everest. There was a special to do. Marquess of Clydesdale, I think it was. I could be wrong over that, but unfortunately, I had the book of the event, but I lent it to one of the local fishermen who was interested in flying, and I never got it back. That was the kind of airplane it was. Open, obviously. You know, the wind whistled around your ears, and minuscule communications to the ground. 20 miles would be a long way. And
Did you feel any affection for the Wapiti?
Yes, I did, because I'd got a lot of time on it, more time on the Wapiti than any other single aeroplane. It was all right. We flew, Guetta is 5,500 feet up, and as you well know, this affects the length of time that it takes to get off the ground, or the distance it takes to get off the ground. And we used to get off the ground at about 95 miles an hour, and the top speed of the cruising speed of the thing was only about 115, so you had a very small bracket of usable speed. But they stayed in the air a long time, 3 or 4 hours endurance, or maybe between 4 and 5.
Did the plane have any visors?
No. No, I don't think it did.
What was flying like in India as compared with Britain? Were conditions must have been fairly different?
Well, it was the most noticeable, obvious thing is the airfield itself, which was merely mud, no vegetation of any kind on it, and no runway. But apart from that, the main difference, I think, was that it got very bumpy as soon as the sun got decently powerful. We were surrounded by mountains up to 16,000 feet, and these generated some pretty heavy bumps, so that all what was known as serious flying took place 6:30 to 10 or something like this in the morning. If you were trying to do high-level bombing or whatever, and you need a steady platform, that's when you did it.
From what one's read about India in the 1930s, about the RAF in India in the 1930s, one gets the impression that the Indian government and the Indian Army treated the RAF rather meanly. Is that true?
I wasn't conscious of it. I was a parallel, so I barely knew there was a group, let alone some great hierarchy above us. I wouldn't know about that. We had I think the army tended to be a bit superior in their relations, but we socially we got along very well, and we were in the same club obviously and all that sort of thing. But I think they still thought of the RAF as a bit of an upstart. It had only been in existence for 20 years, you know, as RAF.
So you didn't feel that there was a lack of equipment and spares and so on?
I was not conscious of it, certainly not.
Did you engage in any operations on the frontier?
Yeah. It comes after the Quetta earthquake, actually. When Quetta fell down and we got the last of the flyable airplanes out, a very beneficent set of authorities noticed that four of us were taking an exam that year to try and get ourselves PCs, permanent commissions. And without any asking on our part, we were posted to Murray up in the hills, and we did virtually nothing but study and revise, which was highly necessary because most of us had to relearn algebra and things like that. And whilst we were there, an operation started from Rysselpore. The gist of it is that the army wanted to make a road up into the tribal territory area, and the tribesmen, as always, objected to this, and they objected by shooting the chaps up a bit. And the Air Force was brought in because the methods of quelling that sort of thing were highly humane. You patrolled their area and said, if you don't keep out of it, out of this prescribed area, we're going to drop bombs or shoot you up. And this used to work because they couldn't manage their crops and they couldn't do all this sort of thing. But nobody ever got killed very much. And we were tolerably safe because we didn't go down into the valleys. Some of it was done by day. You try to keep it up, obviously, for 24 hours a day with a break. They were allowed to go in for a couple of hours or something like that, as I remember. So some of it was by night. And this was the hairy bit, really. It shows the difference in flying then and flying now. When I arrived there, I'd done a few what were known as dusk landings. And this is exactly what it says, and is preparatory to night flying. So I'd never really flown at night when this operation started. But one took off in the dark, flew something like 150 to 200 miles, I guess. Wait a minute. Let's not exaggerate. Say 100 miles, an hour's flying, into the totally impossible hill country on a one in a million map, which is a 16th of an inch to a mile map. And you floated about over that area for an hour or so, and then you came home and you landed. No communication of any kind, nothing but a compass at all, nobody to tell you whether the wind had changed while you were away or whatever. And when you landed, no lights on the airplane, and you landed by the light of a thing called a gooseneck flare, paraffin flare, which was all pretty hit and miss, but we didn't think it was very odd at the time.
Were you ever shot at by the tribe?
Yeah, only once that I remember. It was it was daytime then, and we were flying over the mountains, all mountainous, and there my air gunner let out a yelp, and we had nothing between us except the Gosport tube thing, and said, and I looked down and backwards, and there were a bunch of blokes on the top of this mountain, and you could see the smoke from their rifles, you know, drifting away. And we shot a few rounds of Lewis gun at them, and I don't suppose anybody got hurt. But that was the only retaliation there was.
Were there any holes in the machine when you got down?
No. We had one rather unusual accident during that operation. We were operating from a little place called Abbottabad, which was a very short airfield indeed. You came in, and the moment you were across, you were sure you were going to make it, you had to actually switch the engine off. Because if you left the propeller even idling, you were overshot. Very short. And one guy one night came back with all his bombs. He had maybe 4 20-pounders on either side. Did a perfectly good landing, and then the armourer came out to take the bombs off. And what really happened, nobody knows, but in some way one of them went off while this chap was handling it, and killed him, obviously, filled the aeroplane with splinter holes, and what was so strange, it killed an army clerk who was nearly 100 yards away from the event, sitting in a tent. One piece of shrapnel went through his throat. That's strange.
Which year would that have been, do you think?
If you had to switch off, 1935, I should think.
Can we talk about the Quetta earthquake which you mentioned?
Yeah.
What date was it, do you know?
That was at 3 o'clock in the morning, on the 30th of May. Is it 30 days of September? 31st of May, 1935, and I was woken by the noise, I think, as much as the shaking, the violent shaking, and a terrific noise. The movement was enough to cause the usual lamp standard thing to fall over, and they are supposed to be fairly stable, but I'd hardly collected my thoughts when my bearer came in, which I thought was one of the most remarkable things that ever happened to me, that he'd left his family in the quarters which the service provided for him on the quite near the mess. And he came to see whether I was all right. It was the first thing he did. And it was great. And my quarters were immediately opposite the station commander's quarters. Jack Slessor, who was later, I think, Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Jack Slessor. Certainly Air Chief Marshal. We could look him up in the list if you wanted to. And it was dead silent. But I went over and found his wife wandering about, and she said Jack was still inside, and they had two guests who hadn't emerged. And to cut a long story short, we did get the guests out. They had been saved, really, because a huge wardrobe known as a Almira had fallen across the bed, broken down the side of the bed, but had then left a gap under it, and they were protected from falling masonry by the thing. Well, the Slessor told me to go down to the camp and find out what had gone on down there. It was a mile away, the airmen and the airfield, and that part of the outfit was a mile away. I went down on my bike, still in dressing gown or something, and it was such a disastrous prospect that I never did go back. One had to try and get a chap out, you know. There were a lot of airmen there, and they were buried, and you had to try, and rather than skittle about or again reporting. Probably the wrong decision, but I did, that's what I said. And the first chap, as it happened, and accidentally, was my own air gunner. And one or two people began to turn up, and we dug and pulled stuff about and got this chap out, but he died before he got to the dressing station, which had been set up within the first hour or two. And we lost 50 airmen, which was a very large proportion of the total white casualties. The native casualties were certainly well into the tens of thousands, and nobody ever knew, because there was no way of telling who was there, you know. And looting was the great fear. Is this sort of stuff?
Yes, please.
So we were told to be on alert for that sort of thing. And
did much occur?
Well, no, not that I saw. I was orderly officer that night, and that required me to be to sleep down in the airman's section, the airfield, the technical building, and all that area. And they put me up a little tent there. And I hated that, because I was a little pool of light in the midst of a sea of darkness, and I didn't like it one little bit. So I spent most of the night walking about and looking at the airmen on duty and so on. But we didn't have any trouble. The army had recovered their composure by this time, and there was the odd sort of infantry carrier trundling about around the airfield.
So the city must have looked a terrible mess.
Shambles.
So many.
Yes, I got a couple of pictures somewhere. This was that was the RAF camp. There's the airfield.